All right. I'm going to present a humanist view of the interdependent web of life. From my standpoint, it's undeniable. We live symbiotically, but not always harmoniously. Sometimes it's as large as the obvious hunting of animals, harvesting of grain. It can be intuitive, the replenishing of the forest floor. Or, in my medical world, I'll let you know that you're all a home to a lot of bacteria. And you wouldn't do very well without them. But it can be as small as the sharing of electrons, atoms, and molecules as we touch each other and breathe each other's breath. If we're going to have an image for today for you to carry, I didn't have a chance to grab one. I would love it if anybody knows where the poster is. There's a poster shot, so the image would be a terrarium. The poster that I would love to get my hands on was an old one, I recall, that beautiful shot of the Earth from the moon landing. Beautiful shot of the Earth hanging in the sky with a terrarium around it, reminding us that what happens here stays here. Yep. But I want to start with some good news. I'm going to take it easy on Larry for the first sentence. Okay? The good news is we don't have to save the planet. The planet will take care of itself. It's been here for billions of years. It's going to be here for billions of years. However, there's some bad news. We are taking part in the sixth largest extinction of species that's occurred in the history of the Earth. As in global warming, which may actually be one factor in this sixth extinction that we're participating in, we could debate humanity's role and responsibility for the sixth extinction. But you're foolish to deny its presence. For my readings today, I will read from the book of The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. It's by Elizabeth Colbert. So if you're interested, it's an educational read. But if we're talking about being in the sixth extinction, I should share with you what were the top five. The top five for now. Who knows where the sixth one's going to go? But an extinction would be a time of profound loss of biodiversity for the Earth. Originally, people were thinking that probably all five of these big extinctions occurred for the same reason. But now they're thought to be actually five separate unique events that have occurred, unique combinations of events that have occurred. But the top five so far, just in case you weren't there at the time, 450 million years ago, the end of the Ordovician period, land plants mainly were present, so they didn't complain too much or leave much record for it. Well, they didn't leave a written record. They did leave a record. And probably the inciting event for that one was glaciation. A drop in CO2 levels everywhere caused significant problems for the species that were present. The second one was 375 million years ago, late Devonian period. Mostly you can see it in effects on coral reefs. Quite a track record for what's happening there. And it reflects that there was an ocean acidification going on. Once again, probably a higher level of CO2 present. 250 million years ago was actually the most striking event. It was the end of the Permian period. Reptiles were present by then. It's the largest estimate of species loss. Probably 90% of the species alive at that time perished when that occurred. Warming again seems to be a significant event. There was ocean acidification going on. But there was also simultaneously a lot of volcanic activity, which, as I read this book, was a little disconcerting to me as I was visiting Yellowstone. For those of you who know, all the steam vents and the geysers are all charged by the 4-mile-wide caldera that you're standing on when you're in Yellowstone Park. Probably not the best place to stand. But it does sound, for me as a scientist, kind of cool, 250 million years ago, They think that the ocean was probably acidified enough that it was producing hydrogen sulfide. So you had bubbling gases, toxic gases, coming out of a purple ocean and going up to a green sky. That would be so cool. You wouldn't live long. You wouldn't live long, so you better have good equipment, but sounds like it would be a cool thing to see. 200 million years ago, we had the extinction, fourth extinction, at the late Triassic period. Again, ocean acidification seems to be prominent. The corals show quite a bit of change. However, the fifth extinction is the one that's actually the most famous and popular. Yes, that's the end of the Cretaceous period. It's the end of the dinosaurs. There were some flowering plants and birds that didn't do so well either, and that's the meteor that struck in the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. However, you do have to understand that one of the unexpected consequences of that particular extinction was the rise of the primates, and eventually the humans. So we do owe our presence to one of the major extinction events. But from the book, to the extent that we can identify the causes of these revolutions, they're highly varied. Glaciation in the case of the Endo-Ordovician, global warming and changes in ocean chemistry at the end of the Permian, an asteroid impact in the final seconds of the Cretaceous. The current sixth extinction has its own novel cause, not an asteroid or a massive volcanic eruption, but one weedy species. As Walter Alvarez put it to me, we're seeing right now that a mass extinction can be caused by human beings. We ourselves, we suffer from species privilege. We have lots of privileges around here. Why not throw in another one? We suffer from species privilege. We figure that, yes, indeed, we are chosen and ordained. I think Maya Angelou referred to us as just below the angels. And Genesis likes to take off on this one if you're a Bible fan. Yep. We've developed a high standard of living off of the earth and what it's got for us. We can remain unaware if we wish, or we can be uninspired to change things because we benefit from it. However, we have separated ourselves from nature and the larger web. We refer to things as resources rather than others in the web of life. So we sang Wake Now Our Senses because we want to be aware that we have enough impact that we are actually leaving a global stratigraphic signature on this earth. We used to joke that the layer they would find when they came after us would be plastic. Plastic and styrofoam everywhere. Yep. But actually, more seriously, once again from the book, it seems appropriate to assign the term Anthropocene to the present age. In many ways, human-dominated geologic epoch. Paul Crutzen has observed, among the many geologic scale changes that people have affected, Crutzen cited the following. Human activity has transformed between a third and a half of the land surface of this planet. Most of the world's major rivers that we talked about in our reading with Maya Angelou have been dammed or diverted. Fertilizer plants produce more nitrogen than is fixed naturally by all the terrestrial ecosystems. Fisheries remove more than a third of the primary production of the ocean's coastal waters. And humans use more than half of the world's readily accessible freshwater runoff. Most significantly, Crutzen said, people have altered the composition of the atmosphere. Owing to a combination of fossil fuel combustion and deforestation, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the air has risen by 40% over the last two centuries. While the concentration of methane, an even more potent greenhouse gas, has more than doubled. Because of these anthropogenic emissions, Crutzen wrote, the global climate is likely to depart significantly from natural behavior for many millennia to come. So yeah, we humans are a problem. Actually, we're two problems. First, Our sheer numbers are an issue. We consume the resources that the web offers. We have energy needs for this lifestyle that we have developed. And we just have physical needs for our presence. We take up too much space. As they talk about the spread of humans in the book, they talk about the process of intercontinental spread continued in fits and starts in the past for thousands of years until the species, which is no longer new, has spread to practically every corner of the globe. At this point, several things happen more or less at once that allow Homo sapiens, as the species now calls itself, to reproduce at an unprecedented rate. In a single century, the population doubles, but after that, it doubles again, and then again. Vast forests are raised. Humans do this deliberately in order to feed themselves. But meanwhile, an even stranger and more radical transformation is underway. Some plants and animals adjust by moving, but a great many, at first hundreds and thousands, and finally, perhaps millions, find themselves marooned. Extinction rates soar, and the texture of life changes. No creature has ever altered life on the planet this way before. Our second problem, other than the fact that there's too many of us, is that we introduce invasive species. We shuffle the life balance on the Earth. They refer to this as the new Pangaea. For those who are familiar with plate tectonics, Pangaea was a time when most of the land masses on the Earth right now were together as one large land mass before continental shift, before the plate tectonics got them to separate and start moving. There may have been other land masses, but they're gone now, subducted. But at the time when all the land masses were together, that was Pangaea, referred to as Pangaea, and that would allow any life form to have access to all the land mass available. So if you could survive where the conditions were correct, you had access to everywhere. Once you separated the land masses, then you got your distinct developments going on with different species for different areas, different places. They didn't interact much for many, many, many years. So the problem with the new Pangaea is that with human travel, other things get to travel along. And sometimes these areas that have developed unique life forms can't tolerate the presence of a new invasive species. So, I mean, yeah, nice thing. You increase local diversity, biodiversity, but you decrease the global biodiversity because only those things that are going to take over, do well in other places, eliminate some of the other species that have developed. So as they talk about in the book, the New Pangaea, it says, when exactly the New Pangaea project began is difficult to say. If you count people as an invasive species, the science writer Alan Burdick has called Homo sapiens arguably the most successful invader in biological history. The process goes back 120,000 years or so to the period when the modern humans first migrated in a wave out of Africa. But by the time the humans pushed into North America around 13,000 years ago, they had actually domesticated dogs, which they brought with them across the Bering Land Bridge. The Polynesians, who settled in Hawaii around 1,500 years ago, were accompanied not only by rats, but also by fleas, lice, and pigs. The discovery of the New World initiated a vast biological swap meet, the so-called Columbian Exchange, which took the process to a whole new level. Even as Darwin was elaborating his principles for geographic distribution, those principles were being deliberately undermined by groups known as acclimatization societies. The very year that Darwin published On the Origin of Species, a member of an acclimatization society based in Melbourne, Australia, released the first rabbits into Australia. They've been breeding there like, well, rabbits ever since. And in 1890, a New York group that took as its mission the introduction and acclimatization of such foreign varieties of animals and vegetable kingdom as might prove useful and interesting, imported European starlings to the United States. The head of the group supposedly wanted to bring to America all the birds mentioned in Shakespeare. An interesting undertaking. 100 starlings let loose in Central Park have now multiplied to more than 200 million. So these changes from our numbers, from invasive species, they may be intentional or they may be unintentional. We have habitat changes that are both. Wide swatches of the earth are denuded, as we say, forests raised for food, for resource, for land to live on. But they can be unintentional too. There was an interesting chapter in the book that talks about the study of islands on dry land. These are areas where natural habitats are preserved in a limited size. It can be even a couple miles square. But the idea being, well, if we preserve natural habitat, we'll preserve natural species. We'll preserve the native species. What they're finding with the islands, and this would relate to a lot of how we break up the U.S. for areas we settle and areas that we have for natural habitat, is that even though you have the natural areas, because they don't have the interconnectedness, species numbers drop in those areas, even if you try to preserve an island. So some of it's unintentional, but some of the habitat changes are intentional. You have the invasive species introduction. Most of it's unintentional, but some of it's been intentional, especially with the species introduction that we just talked about. And we have species eradication programs that have occurred locally, bison and wolf in our area, not to mention the indigenous populations. Okay, I'm going to date myself. Who remembers the cartoon Pogo? All right, I've got some company. There is one cute one where they are fighting, and one of the little characters comes across the hill, and he says, "We have met the enemy, and they are us." So, yeah, we're the enemy. So our challenge, as I mentioned before, is not to save the planet. Our challenge is to maintain sustainability. The large of it, you got changing the environment. That's going to be a toughie. That's a corporate project. But from these extinction events, the one feature of these disparate events, the one thing they have in common is change. And to be more specific, the rate of change. When the world changes faster than species can adapt, many fall out. This is the case whether the agent drops from the sky in a fiery streak or drives to work in a Honda. Ouch. Okay. To argue that the current extinction event could be averted if people just cared more and were willing to make more sacrifices is not wrong, exactly. Still, it misses the point. It doesn't matter whether people care or don't care. What matters is that people change the world. This capacity predates modernity, though, of course, modernity is its fullest expression. Indeed, this capacity is probably indistinguishable from the qualities that make us human to begin with. Our restlessness, our creativity, our ability to cooperate, to solve problems, and complete complicated tasks. As soon as humans started using signs and symbols to represent the natural world, they pushed beyond the limits of that world. If you want to think about why humans are so dangerous to other species, you can picture a poacher in Africa carrying an AK-47, or a logger in the Amazon gripping an axe, or better still, you can picture yourself holding a book on your lap. Changing the habitat's the large of it. The small of it, we may not even be the most important consideration in this event. from the book. Obviously, the fate of our own species concerns us disproportionately, but at the risk of sounding anti-human, I will say that it is not, in the end, what's most worth attending to. Right now, in the amazing moment that to us counts as the present, we are deciding, without quite meaning to, which evolutionary pathways will remain open and which will forever be closed. No other creature has ever managed this, and it will, fortunately or unfortunately, be our most enduring legacy. What happens to us in all of this? One possibility, the possibility that's implied by the Hall of Biodiversity, is that we too will eventually be undone by our transformation of the ecological landscape. The logic behind this way of thinking runs as follows. Having freed ourselves from the constraints of evolution, humans nonetheless remain dependent on the Earth's biological and geochemical systems. By disrupting these systems, cutting down tropical rainforests, altering the composition of the atmosphere, acidifying the oceans, we're putting our own survival in danger. Among the many lessons that emerge from the geologic record, perhaps the most sobering is that in life, just as in mutual funds, past performance is no guarantee of future results. When a mass extinction occurs, it takes out the weak and also lays low the strong. Another possibility considered by some to be more upbeat is that human ingenuity will outrun any disaster human ingenuity sets in motion. So wouldn't it be better, practically and ethically, to focus on what can be done to save species rather than to speculate gloomily about a future in which the biosphere is reduced? The director of a conservation group in Alaska once put it this way, people have to have hope. I have to have hope. It's what keeps us going. So our task is to be awake and be aware. Having been alerted to the ways in which we're imperiling other species, can't we take action to protect them? Isn't the whole point of trying to peer into the future so that seeing dangers ahead, we can change the course to avoid them? Or put a different way, in a popular yearly ritual at the winter solstice, tell me, spirit, are these the shadows of things that must be, or merely shadows of what may be? But from the sixth extinction, certainly humans can be destructive and short-sighted. They can also be forward-thinking and altruistic. Time and time again, people have demonstrated that they care about what Rachel Carson called the problem of sharing our Earth with other creatures, and that they're willing to make sacrifices on those creatures' behalves. So as individuals, which is the small of it, we can try to minimize our footprint. If you want a starting place, you can read from the Institute for Voluntary Simplicity. It's out of the Northwest. They have a manual. I think they have a movement going, so you can read some of their current information. The large of it is corporately. You can join groups. You can try to influence policies. You can call for corporations instead of, as Larry was mentioning earlier, being profit-driven. You can ask them to consider triple bottom line thinking, which is their profit, but how they influence people and how they influence the environment. You can read Al Gore. He was just on this week. CPR had an interview with him because he's got the new book or the new movie coming out. So he talks about alternating between hope and despair for what's going to happen to humanity. He's mostly into the global warming, but it influences the sixth extinction also. This advice is simple, but I don't mean to imply easy. I'm a physician. When I see patients in the office who want to talk about weight loss, I tell them the mathematics of weight loss is simple. You have to eat fewer calories than you burn. It all comes down to the same math, no matter who you are, no matter what diet you want to follow. It is different for different people. There is individual factors that make it more or less easy for individuals, but it all does come down to the same simple math. Eat fewer calories than you burn. So for the sixth extinction, it's simple also. You have to make a smaller footprint. You have to tread more lightly upon this blue boat that we're all riding as we take it home. Individually and corporately, you have to make less of an impact on the earth. It's a long-term project. It's not simple, not easy. It is simple, but it's not easy. But it's a long-term project. Next year doesn't matter. What matters is what's going to happen down the road. We here in this room will not see the outcome. We have to trust in the web of life and give it the chance to do what it needs to do. It's more down the line of the Native Americans' philosophy of your decisions are based on the seventh generation, your effect on the seventh generation, and how they're going to do. So be awake, be aware, and repeat after me. We affirm and promote, respect for the independent web of all existence. Of which we are a part.